Kim Philby was arguably the most remarkable spy in the history of espionage. He rose through the ranks of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service to become the head of counterintelligence and the British liaison to the FBI and the CIA. But all that time, Philby was really on assignment for the KGB. He was a Soviet spy with the mission of penetrating British intelligence, a mission at which he was remarkably successful. Philby defected to the Soviet Union in 1963. My guest Philip Knightley conducted a series of interviews with Philby a month before Philby's death in May of 1988. Knightley was the last journalist to interview Philby and the only Western journalist to interview him in depth since his defection. Philip Knightley was a special correspondent for the London Sunday Times for over 20 years and is the author of a history of 20th century espionage called The Second Oldest Profession. His new book is a biography of Philby based on their interviews called The Master Spy. Knightley told me why he wanted to talk with Philby.
Back in 1967, I was a member of a Sunday Times team of reporters, Sunday Times of London, that is, who had reconstructed Kim Philby's life by talking to people who knew him. But the problem of such a reconstruction and writing a biography about the person is that you never get a full, rounded picture of the man himself. And I was absolutely fascinated, not so much by Philby's treachery and not so much by what details of what he'd given away to the Soviet Union, but his motivations and his psychology and his beliefs and his politics. So I started writing to him, and over a 20-year period, I suppose we exchanged 3 or 4 letters each year. And in those letters, I would say, come on, Mr. Philby, time's passing. Isn't it time that you let me come to Moscow and have a chat with you? And he resolutely would reply, no, don't like the press, don't want to talk to newspaper men, nothing to say, they won't let me, etc., etc. And then suddenly, late in 1967, I got a letter that said, if you'd care to come with just you and your notebook, no tape recorders and no television cameras, hate television, he said, I can't stand, takes away all the dignity from solemn occasions. Then maybe there is a possibility in the near future that we might be able to have a long chat. And a couple of weeks later, I got a telegram saying, come to Moscow.
And when was this?
This was in January 1988, just a little over 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were criticized by some of your colleagues or former colleagues in the London Sunday Times, who they said that, listen, if he wants to tell his propaganda, let him tell it to his Vestia or Pravda.
Indeed.
What made you think that he was going to be honest with you?
Well, I had no guarantee he was going to be honest with me. The actual criticism was, why make a journalistic pilgrimage to Moscow? If Philby wants to talk to tell his story, let him tell it to Vestia or Pravda. My answer to that was that every one of those journalists who made such a criticism would have gone like a shot himself.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know whether he's going to be honest or not. I didn't know what would happen, but you have to be there to find out. Of course, to this day, I don't know whether he's 100% right. Honest with me. I don't know whether there was some disinformation sowed in that. I mean, one of the criticisms that CIA officers make, I heard of one who had said, the KGB played Knightley beautifully, but if they were playing me, what was the game? Nobody's yet been able to explain to me what the game might have been.
Was there any resistance either in England or the Soviet Union to your trip?
He must have got clearance from the KGB, although he did say to me that they weren't entirely happy with the idea of me being there. And I think there may have been resistance in other quarters in the Soviet Union, because, believe it or not, here is this man, a senior officer, a general in what's said to be one of the most powerful intelligence services in the world. And when I was leaving, he said to me, oh, by the way, if there's any trouble at the airport and they take away your notes, I'll do my best to get them back for you. Now, I never quite found out who they were, but I suspect it was the militia. And I think there was some rivalry between the militia and the KGB. And he couldn't be certain that I would be allowed to leave the Soviet Union with the notes that I had of our interview.
Do you think that your interview was bugged?
I asked him that question, and he said, I don't know and I don't care. He said, I suspect not, because it's no good bugging somebody unless you're prepared to play back those hours and hours of tapes and transcribe them and read them and try and make some sense of them. I suspect that they probably bugged these particular interviews I had with him just for the record. And I suspect the reason he wouldn't let me take a tape recorder was that he didn't want another record apart from the official one.
Speaking with Philip Knightley about his new biography of Kim Philby called The Master Spy. Now, you said you were most interested in what his motivations were for becoming a Soviet spy. He was recruited in, I think it was 1934, while he was at Cambridge.
Yes.
What did you find out about his motivations for turning?
Well, he was 21 years of age at the time, you know, and that's pretty young. And he said he looked around him. He'd studied at Cambridge. He studied economics and history. And he looked around him and he decided that, as he put it, quote, the world, the poor of this world had had it too damn bad for too damn long, and the rich had had it too good for too damn long. And he said the question then became, once I'd made that decision, what I was to do about it. And he felt he should do something about it. You know, he's one of those Englishmen who wants to be involved. Politics are part of his life. So he said, I also looked around me and I saw that Britain was a class-ridden society, that fascism was on the march in Europe and the Far East, and that nobody seemed to be prepared to stand up to it. In fact, some of the leaders of Britain seemed quite content with the idea that eventually Britain might be a fascist state. So he said, I looked at the established British parties, and they didn't appear to be bothered or doing anything about it. I looked at the established European parties, the Social Democrats. They didn't appear to be an effective bulwark against the rise of fascism. And all I could find in the world at that time prepared to make a stand against the rise of the fascist world was the Soviet Union. So he said, I made my commitment to the Soviet Union, and I stuck with it right throughout the worst of Stalinism, right throughout the show trials. And I remained a faithful communist to the last of my days.
Of course, it's one thing to oppose fascism, and it's another thing to sell out your own country.
Yes, he says, I betrayed no one. From the moment I made that commitment, I was a serving member of the Soviet intelligence service. And as such, my assignment was to pretend to be something I wasn't and to penetrate British intelligence. Now, if they were foolish enough to fall for my pose, then that's their lookout.
What was his pose?
That he was a typical middle-class English son of a civil servant who was interested in entering the British intelligence world and making a career out of it.
Now, why were they interested in admitting him? Do you think he had a particular talent for spying? He really rose pretty quickly in intelligence.
He did, indeed. Well, he rose quickly because he was recruited in wartime and they were desperately short of people who had any ability. The march of the Germans across Europe had rolled up most of the British intelligence network in Europe. There was the old and decrepit leadership at home, had no new or bright ideas. They recruited him because he'd come to their attention in Spain, where he'd been a war correspondent, and because his father knew somebody in the service, and this person in the service recommended him. And this person went back to the office after a lunch with Kim and said, I've got a marvelous new recruit for him. For us, I knew his father in India. That's the way recruiting was done in Britain in the intelligence services in those days.
One of the really amazing things that Philby did was to rise and become the head of counter-espionage in England. I mean, imagine a Soviet spy heading up counter-espionage.
Well, at the end of the war, the powers that be in the Foreign Office looked around at who was who in British intelligence, and they noticed Philby's career during the war. They rewarded him with an OBE, quite a high decoration. And they kept him on, the only civilian employed by British intelligence during the war who was kept on after the war. And they had a job for him. That's why they kept him on. They wanted him to move from the Iberian subpeninsula, where he'd been doing counter-espionage work, to become head of Section 9, which had been set up late in 1944, to conduct aggressive intelligence operations against the Soviet Union. So the man, as you say, who was in head of the British intelligence department handling aggressive intelligence operations against the Soviet Union, was himself a Soviet agent.
Did Philby tell you anything about the kind of ongoing communications he had with the KGB while he was heading up counterintelligence in England?
No, he was very careful not to reveal what he called KGB operational methods that might still be valid. But we know that he had regular, if infrequent, contact with his KGB control, the man who inspired him in the first place, who explained to him what dedication the job would need. As for the actual day-by-day communication, although I don't think it did take place day-by-day, I think Philby met as rarely as possible so that there would be no chance of him being exposed, at which he passed on information of long-term strategic significance to the Soviet Union, he would not talk about.
Now, one of the things he did while he headed up counterintelligence in England was to change the section from purely defensive to intelligence gathering. What was his motivation for doing that? Did he explain?
Yes, he did. He said the aim of British or all Western intelligence operations against the Soviet Union in the early days of the Cold War, which as far as the intelligence service, Western intelligence services were concerned, began before the actual end of the war, were to try to splinter away various outposts of the Soviet Empire and swing them into the Western camp. Now, this involved dropping of agents prepared to commit sabotage, murder, and subversion in those countries to set up safe houses, to expand networks and things like that. And Philby claimed that the best way of doing this was to conduct, not to just to remain passive and wait to see what the Soviet Union did, but to actually push these operations as far as was possible. Of course, all these operations failed miserably because Philby had betrayed the general outlines of the plan to Moscow before they even began.
Did he tell you anything about how he operated in that position? And how he could intentionally undermine the British intelligence?
Yes, I mean, he was vague on actual details, but he said that he'd ran an operation in 45 and 46 from Sweden into Latvia, inserting into genuine Latvian refugees returning home from Sweden a number of SIS, British intelligence, recruited agents whose job it was to set up safe houses, collect arms, and train people for sabotage missions. And he'd personally taken charge of such an operation, I think probably just to learn the details of what happened, and how it worked. But though the Soviet intelligence service was very careful not to use him for fairly low-level stuff, nuts and bolts details of intelligence, in case they had exposed a man that they, or risk exposure, a man that they eventually hoped would be head of the whole British intelligence system.
What's the extent of the damage that he was responsible for in British intelligence?
Well, if you take his whole career from 41 until 51, when he was negated or neutralized, I think it splits fairly equally into neatly into two parts. There was the services that he could render the Soviet Union during the war, which were also valuable. Three parts, let's make it, which were also valuable to Britain. In other words, he straight counterintelligence work in Spain and Portugal that made it difficult for German intelligence to penetrate Britain. That was of equal value to Britain as the Soviet Union, so he saw absolutely no conflict and duty in what he was doing. Then he had a secret role in assisting the Soviet Union to keep abreast of developments in Britain, which Moscow was worried might lead to a separate peace between Germany, the United States, and Britain, and a switching of the war away from Germany to a combined front against the Soviet Union, where at the moment that was first considered, the Germans stood on the brink of success. The Soviet Union was absolutely paranoid about such a possibility, remembering the Allied intervention in Russia just after the Bolshevik Revolution, when something like 26 countries were desperately trying to put down Lenin and Trotsky and the whole Bolshevik movement. So they'd set up Philby in a position in British intelligence to keep them advised against any repeat of history there. That was an important information service he was able to provide the Soviet Union. Then, on a practical level, he was able to divert or downgrade any attempts for the separate peace which came from Germany. I mean, German peace feelers had to come through neutral countries. They usually came through Spain and Portugal. They passed across Philby's desk, and he had to evaluate how genuine these offers were. And he would routinely say that they weren't genuine offers, they were probably a provocation, that the source had passed them on was unreliable, and so these papers were never circulated. You could, by stretching it a little, say that in doing this, chances for an earlier end to the war were probably lost. Now then, the second part of, or the third part of his role, was when he was at the heart of Western intelligence, in the whole Western intelligence effort against the Soviet Union, during his posting to Washington when he was CIA liaison officer with the FBI and the CIA.
This is in 1949 that he comes to the stage.
49 to 51. When he was able to tell Moscow, keep Moscow abreast of all the long-term strategic aims of the covert action that both services were waging against the Soviet Union.
Did he tell you about any close calls when he thought he was close to blowing his cover?
He had two, one in Spain, when the Spanish police nearly got him, and at a time during the Spanish Civil War when the punishment for espionage was being put against the wall and shot immediately, he was nearly caught with some Soviet one-time code pads in his pocket. This was because he was foolishly carrying them around with him, and he'd gone on a trip and he'd found himself in an area for which he didn't have a pass, and the Spanish police asked him to empty his pockets. And of course, if they'd found that on him, then he was finished. His career as a Soviet spy would have been over virtually before it began. But he managed to wriggle out of that by throwing his wallet, when they asked him to empty his pockets, violently onto the desk so it skidded off and fell to the floor. And while the policemen were bending over to pick it up, he quickly slipped the piece of paper from his pocket and swallowed it. The other occasion was in 1945, when there was a defector, a Soviet defector in Istanbul, called Volkov, who volunteered to come over to the West and offered us his little menu of titbits that he would provide Western intelligence once his visa and payment of money had been made to him. And among those titbits was the names of three members of the Foreign Service. And don't forget, the SIS comes under British Foreign Service, Foreign Office. The names of three Foreign Office officers who were actual Soviet agents. Now, the other two were Burgess and MacLean, and the third was clearly Philby. But the agent was not about to reveal this until the details of his defection had been arranged. And while it was going to take about a week or so Volkov left the British consulate, making arrangements for meetings in a week's time. Now, the information was quickly relayed to London, where the head of British intelligence said, "This is a defector of utmost importance, and I'm going to put my best man on the job." And he put on the job, guess who? Our old friend Kim Philby. So Philby, before leaving for Istanbul to interview this defector, who knew Philby's name but not what he looked like, but was in a perfect position to blow Philby's cover, made a call to Moscow, and by the time that he arrived there to interview the defector had mysteriously disappeared.
Hmm. How was Philby's cover finally blown?
Well, in 1951, the man Burgess that I just mentioned to you, and MacLean, the other two of the three who would have been named by this defector if he'd ever made it to Britain, MacLean was coming under suspicion for the passing of certain information that had been available to him in his role as First Secretary in the British Embassy in the immediate post-war period. And MacLean had undergone such worry and nervous tension over this that it was thought by his Moscow control that he would be unable to withstand interrogation, and the decision was taken that he should get out of Britain and defect to the Soviet Union. Burgess was to help him in this escape, but not to go himself. Unknown to Philby and Philby's control in Washington, Burgess decided that he would go too, because he too was at the end of his nervous energy tether. And instead of just MacLean going, and again I stress unknown to Philby and Philby's KGB control, Burgess went as well. Now, this immediately compromised Philby, because Philby had had Burgess living with him in his house in Washington. A very bad tradecraft for the KGB, and one of their major blunders, because it blew a 30-year-long operation to get Philby into the position of being head of British intelligence. Once Burgess and MacLean had gone, people in Washington, notably J. Edgar Hoover, said, "Hey, wait a minute, there's something funny here. Burgess has been living with Philby. Philby is supposed to be the world's greatest counterintelligence officer. Now, either he isn't the world's greatest counterintelligence officer, so what is he? Or he has been involved in Burgess's escape himself." So from that moment on, General Walter Beadle Smith, the head of the CIA, and J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, cut off all relations with Britain, British intelligence, until such time as Philby was gone.
Was it difficult for him to get out and get to the Soviet Union?
That came later. At this stage, in 51, all that happened was that he, because of the cutting off of relations until Philby was got rid of, Philby was recalled to Britain, given a sort of kangaroo court trial, a sort of fake trial in the offices of SIS to see what sort of evidence could be mounted against him that might stand some chance of convicting him in a court of law. He withstood that interrogation and that fake trial brilliantly. So because there was no possibility of employing him again, he, due to pressure from America, he had to go, and he was pensioned off and paid off with a lump sum. But then about 4 years later, under pressure again, but this time from J. Edgar Hoover, who'd mounted a little undercover publicity operation to get Philby exposed, the British government was forced to make a statement which, instead of, as Hoover had hoped, would have announced that Philby was the third man who tipped off Burgess and Maclean about their impending interrogation, because there was not enough evidence to make that stand up in the statement, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary Harold Macmillan, had to say that actually there was no evidence that Philby had indeed been a Soviet spy or the third man. In other words, Philby was cleared. That gave him another valuable 8 years, because his friends saying, ha-ha, here it is, Philby cleared, he was the victim of McCarthyism, let's find him a job, a freelance job. And they found him a freelance job as a journalist, and he worked out of Beirut for the next 8 years. And at the end of those 8 years, when evidence from elsewhere, namely that from a Soviet defector called Galitzin, arrived and put the final marks on Philby's treachery, he had to get out of town, and he left and went home to Moscow, as he puts it.
Really a remarkable career of deceit. You visited him in the Soviet Union, the only Western journalist to have an interview with him there. How did he seem to be treated by Soviets and by the government, by the KGB, by his neighbors? I mean, do you have a lot of stature when you're when you've been a mole for so many years and
indeed,
then you defect to the Soviet Union?
Indeed. So you have to understand that a defector, Philby may be considered a traitor and a defector and to have betrayed his country in Western terms, but in Soviet terms, he was a hero. And I know this because of the awards that he won, as I said, Order of the Red Banner and Order of the Order of Lenin, the sort of apartment he occupied, a very large three-bedroom apartment in the heart of Moscow with inside of the Kremlin walls, the privileges he had, a chauffeur-driven black car anytime he wanted to go anywhere, a house in the country, freedom to travel anywhere within the Soviet bloc and even overseas. He visited Cuba on one occasion. So it was clear to me that he was well thought of by the authorities. I don't think his neighbors knew who he was. I mean, they knew that he was not Russian-born, and they knew that he probably had something to do with the government. But exactly who he was, I don't think his neighbors knew.
You don't suspect he ever had any remorse?
Remorse, regret, we discussed this. He said that at one stage he felt that he was... he'd made the wrong choice during that Brezhnev period, and that he took to drinking a lot and was drinking on suicidal binges, but that the arrival of a new woman in his life, a half-Russian, half-Polish woman called Rufa, to whom he was married at the time of his death, an increased use of him by the KGB when Andropov, his ex-boss, took over as first secretary of the Communist Party, and the arrival on the scene, finally, of Gorbachev, and a leader who he felt he'd been waiting for all his life, made him absolutely unregretful, without remorse, proud of his life and its achievements, and he died a happy and contented man.
Is it harder now to write about espionage in England? And I'm thinking of, you know, in the light of attempts to censor the Spycatcher book.
Yes, well, there were attempts to censor my book as well. We had my publisher had a letter from the head of the Dino's Committee, which offers, quote, voluntary, unquote, advice to publishers and newspapers about what they should and should not print, asking to see an advance copy of the manuscript. And my publisher, with some vigor, replied that he was not accustomed to submitting things for pre-censorship. And the Dino's man went away. But he will not go away as easily later this year when the Official Secrets Act steadily making its way through the British Parliament comes into power, because it makes an offence for the unauthorised disclosure of anything which might harm British interests abroad or damage international relations. And the definition of harm and damage in both cases is that what is defined by the British government.
Do you think embarrassment might come under that heading?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they're much more likely under the heading of harm than anything else you could probably think of.
What is the most surprising thing that Philby had to tell you?
Surprising? He didn't surprise me much because I...
Or the story that puts his... the story he told a Jew that puts his story in a new light.
The saddest thing he told me was to say that he was two people... a political person and a private person, that he always put, when the two clashed, then his political persona always won out. that he would sacrifice wife, family, children, and everything for his political beliefs. And I said I couldn't understand anybody feeling so strongly about politics being prepared to do that. And he said, well, that's the sort of person I am. I mean, that was surprising because we parted ways there. I suppose the single most surprising thing was his obvious admiration for Mrs. Thatcher. And I puzzled over this for a long while, and it occurred to me that the reason is that he admired strong political views strongly held, and that it didn't matter that much to him that maybe political views from the opposite side of the political spectrum as he had, but the fact that they were strongly held, I think he felt, went some way to justifying his own stance.
Philby died about a month after you interviewed him.
Yes, I had nothing to do with it.
But that, do you think of that as just being coincidence, or is there any mysterious circumstances surrounding his death?
No mysterious circumstances. I discussed this at length with his widow. He'd been ill several times. He'd had what, in retrospect, were clearly minor strokes. He led a vigorous and nerve and enervating life. He was a heavy drinker and a heavy smoker. And I think it all just caught up with him. And don't forget, he was 76, which is not a bad innings.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. I've enjoyed it.